Well, good morning to everyone. Good to be here again. I want to talk to the children just for a minute. All the children, look at Brother Ted, look up here. The music, the singing is such a blessing to us. And I just want to thank you personally and bless God for your abilities. Thank you very much, children, for your singing. It's such an inspiration. So, with no further ado, shall we kneel for prayer? Our Heavenly Father, we do come before you today with grateful hearts, and those are not trite words. It's a pleasure to bend our knees in your direction and to know that you hear us. You're the true and living God. You're the sovereign God, the almighty God, and you're present with us today. I do pray that you would speak to our hearts where we need speaking to, and that we might be encouraged to walk with you, to walk on the King's highway, to be godly men and women, to bear much fruit. May we always realize the brevity of life, the vapor we are, and may we live, Father, with that understanding. May we have a blessed message. May it glorify you. In Jesus' name, amen. I have kind of a practical message here today. Do we need this thing right here? Oh, good. I have kind of a practical message today, and it's a message that speaks to my heart. And I think at somewhere in the message you'll each find yourself somehow, somewhere. I want to start with a question. The question is, have you ever made a mess out of something in your life? Have you ever made a mess? Have you ever made a mess messier? Worse than what it really was at the beginning? Have you ever made some kind of a mess in your life worse? Not intentionally, of course, but nevertheless, you made your small mess into something quite huge. In other words, in trying to clean up your mess, you only worsened the mess. There was this family of five people, and they had a dog, an inquisitive dog. And one day, the dog jumped up on the shelf, and down came 3 gallons of paint on the floor. Well, fortunately, only 1 gallon opened. 2 of them stayed closed. And you know how, I don't know about you, but We keep our paint around a long time. I don't know, there's something about paint. We just can't throw it away, even if it's just a trifle bit in the bottom of the can. There's just something about paint that makes us save it and save it and save it. And then a few years later down the road, we toss it away anyhow. Well, it was one of those kinds of cans that came open. It was an oil-based can. Oil-based paint, and it made quite a mess. The family, they heard something fall off of the shelf, and the paint was bright, bright yellow, and the lid flew off. And there they were, with a black lab with a bright yellow nose, one can lying on its side with the lid off. And the paint had oozed out onto the floor in about a 12-inch diameter circle, not very far. It wasn't splattered all over the floor. So the original mess was only about a foot in diameter, and then the cleanup began. By the time the cleanup was finished by the dad, it was spread out halfway across the floor, across the cement floor. It looked like an entire gallon of paint had been spilled. Thus, the mess was made worse. The mess became messier. If you think about it, just for a moment, each of you think about it, I'm sure each one of you could tell a story. I used to help my uncle when I was young do a little remodeling. He bought a rental that needed a lot of work. He wanted to divide it into to an apartment. And every time we started something, we thought, oh, we'll just tear this wall out and put up a wall and move this door. We always got into something worse. Electrical problems, plumbing problems. The mess always got worse. And it always took us much longer than we ever thought. And like I said, each one of you probably have a story you could relate to and talk about your mess this morning. But what happens when your financial mess becomes messier? What happens when your marriage becomes a mess and becomes messier? What happens when personal relationships you have become messier? What happens within your family when your family relationships become messier? What happens when you make your morality mess into something messier? What happens when you make your job, your profession, messier? It just goes on and on and on. When you make a mess, often you make it messier. And here's the reason we make messes in our lives messier. And this is what I'm going to talk about today. Every mess you make, every mess you're involved in, whether you marry into a mess, whether you're born into a mess, whether you inherited a mess, whether you created the mess, whether by some means you were dragged into a mess, every mess comes with some bad options. To get out of your mess, just borrow more money. Just lie bigger. Destroy the evidence. Just deny everything. Hide. Make up a story. That'll get you out of your mess. Here's a good way. Move away. Move away. Move to a different church. Send another text to that same person and just tell them, oh, that text wasn't meant for you. It wasn't meant for you at all. There are always, always, always some really bad options. Bad options, bad choices that come with every mess. And of course, your bad options essentially always make your mess worse. They make your mess worse. So, in the next few minutes, I want to talk to you about messier, making your mess worse. I want to look in the Word and see how a godly man handled his mess, and he was in quite a mess. He was in a huge mess, and what he did. And my prayer is that this message might save you some time from messier. Because some of you are in a mess today. And some messes, however, are totally unavoidable, and I understand that. And with some messes, there's no way to go back and unmake the mess. But listen to me. Because with every mess, even ones you're currently facing today, whether it's a financial mess, a family mess, a relational mess, whether it's a mess in your home, whether it's a mess on your job, whether it's a mess in your personal life that nobody knows about, whatever it might be, my friends, There are some really, really bad options that come from your mess. And you're being tempted, like all of us are tempted, to opt for something that's going to make your mess much messier. So how do you avoid making your mess messier? How do you do that? I want to reinforce you to a very, very specific idea. And I'm going to introduce this idea to you through a man in the Bible this morning. And all of you know his story. I want you to do me a favor today. Don't let your mind run ahead of me to the end of the story. Hopefully you can just track along with me through the whole story and get the meaning. It's a story that takes place about 1,000 years before Christ. Many, many years. It's the story of David. The story of David. And all of you say, oh, you know the story of David. I want you to track with me. Please don't go ahead of me. And the story takes place before David actually becomes the king. The story starts when David was a little boy. And one day the prophet Samuel visited the home, showed up at David's home and told his dad, I'm going to anoint one of your boys king. And he ended up anointing David to be the king. David was the king. He was anointed when he was a little boy. But he was still a shepherd boy. The problem was, when they anointed David, when Samuel anointed David, Israel already had a king. So now Israel kind of has two kings. A grown-up king, King Saul, and they have a little shepherd boy, David, who just went back to tending his sheep. Well, as time went by, David made himself very well known in the land of Israel. And one day, you all know the story, David went to visit his brother who was serving in the army, the Israelite army. And there was Goliath in the valley. And David knew that there wasn't too much difference between a giant, a lion, or a bear. And he'd killed a lion and a bear. So David pulled back his sling and kills Goliath. And when David killed Goliath, he became an overnight sensation in Israel. Everybody, all of a sudden, knew the name David. After all, he killed Goliath in front of the entire Israelite army. And now everybody was talking about David. And not many people were talking about King Saul. I want to tell you people something I found out and discovered in my life, and you have probably discovered or soon will discover, there's a stone for every Goliath in your life. There's always a stone for every Goliath. In fact, in Samuel 18:14-16, it says this, in everything he did, talking about David, he had great success. In everything David did, and when Saul saw that David behaved wisely and had great success, Saul became afraid of David. Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came before them. And in Samuel 18, that means he went out and came before them. That means he was a leader. He led out. He was a leader. He had great success. Saul became afraid of him. People loved David. And David led them out. He was their leader. There's a real interesting thing here, and maybe you've noticed it. Here it is. The people who lead are perceived as the leaders, or ones to follow, whether they have the title or they don't have the title. So David kind of became the one they wanted to follow. Being a leader, to step out and lead, for anyone to do that, you'll have a following if you're successful. King Saul had the title king, but David was the one who stepped out and led. And because David led, people began to perceive David as the leader of the army, even though he wasn't officially, and perhaps even the leader of the nation. And perhaps it was true. David was going to be the next king. So Saul realizes he has a problem on his hands. So Saul comes up with a way to control David. He keeps things from getting worse. King Saul decides he's going to marry one of his daughters to David. Why? Because then he can control him. He would be the son-in-law. So he goes to David and he offers one of his daughters. And King David responds and says, "Oh, King Saul, what an honor. But I'm just a lowly shepherd boy from a family that's not very important. I'm not worthy of this honor to marry your daughter." Well, the word gets out soon. And the next thing you know, David is known as David the Humble. David the Humble. Because anybody would surely marry the king's daughter if he offered it. David the Humble. He gave up this wonderful opportunity to be part of the king's family. Well, anyhow, things continue to happen with David. David gets more and more and more popular. And King Saul becomes more and more jealous. And one of the king's daughters actually falls in love with David. And David actually falls in love with her. So King Saul thought, "I'll try this again." And apparently, David was really in love with this girl. Because when King Saul goes to David again, this time with David, "Will you marry my daughter?" David says, "Yes, I'll marry her." And King Saul says, "Aha, I've got him. Well, the bride price for my daughter, King David, or what you must pay for my daughter is not any amount of money. It's not oxen or sheep or camels. It's not goats. David, the price you have to pay to marry my daughter is 100 dead Philistines. You must kill 100 Philistines to marry my daughter." Well, the plan was perfect. Saul figured there was no way in the world David was ever going to kill 100. David and his men could never kill 100 Philistines. Well, David and his men go on the hunt for Philistines. And they end up killing not 100, but actually 200 Philistines. Guess what? This made things even worse for Saul. In fact, if you want to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 18, I can just read it for you here. 1 Samuel 18:28, this is what happens here. "Thus Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David." Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. Which meant Saul was not going to be able to manipulate his daughter to control David. Why not? Because God was with him. And Saul realized whatever he would try to do, God superseded. So what happens in verse 29? 18:29. "And Saul was still more afraid of David. So Saul becomes David's enemy continually." So, my friends, what's our connection with this story so far? So what? Well, have you ever made a mess worse? Have you ever made your mess messier? Have you made it a bigger mess? David has a big mess on his hands now. And here's the unique thing. And here's why this is so relevant to us and so real to us today. David has a huge mess on his hands, but it's not his fault. I mean, it's not like the messes I make and the messes you make sometimes. They're kind of like our fault. My messes are usually always my fault. David never asked to be king. The whole Goliath thing, all he was doing was putting his nation in front of himself and wanting to protect some people. The whole, "I'll lead out in the campaign, I'll be your leader." Again, he was just trying to protect his people. He had even refused the king's daughter at one time. But no matter what he does, things get worse and worse and worse. And David's mess gets worse and worse and worse. Finally, things continue to escalate, and King Saul tries to kill David. Saul completely loses it. He picks up a spear, he hurls it at David, trying to kill David in the palace. Of course, David runs for his life and heads out into the desert as his mess becomes worse. From that point on, Saul has it out for David. He wants to kill David. You see, Saul was filled with jealousy. He wanted his son Jonathan to be the next king, not David. And as long as David was alive, he was a threat to the king. He was a threat to the kingdom. And he was a threat to King Saul's family. When David leaves the city, David goes out into the wilderness. Basically, he goes to hide and to run from Saul. David gathers around him all of Saul's enemies. Saul had many, many political enemies, and now David becomes an outlaw to Saul. And David gathers around him a band of women and a band of men, and before long, everywhere he goes, there's a crowd that comes to follow him. But he's an outlaw now, and Saul has not lost his desire to kill David. Now, this is when the story gets really interesting. This is why you should read your Bible. This is amazing. Here's where the story picks up. 1 Samuel chapter 24, verse 1. Now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told to him, saying, "Take note, David is in the wilderness at En Gedi." Sometimes it's pronounced Ein Gedi. And Ruby and I have been to Ein Gedi, and it's exactly the way the Bible describes it, exactly. It's called in the Bible the land of goats, and talks about a small stream of water that comes out of a rock. So that's where David goes to hide out. And Saul is out busy fighting the Philistines, and the Philistines lived throughout Judah and Israel. And King Saul and the Philistines were lifetime enemies, lifetime enemies. There was this continual battle back and forth between Israel and the Philistines. 2,017 years later, it hasn't stopped. So now, Saul is returning from the battle. The men are hungry, tired, a lot of them are bloody. They're ready to go home. They've lost their friends, some of their comrades. And someone comes up and says, "Saul, Saul, we've spotted David. David and his men, and we think we've got them cornered." 24:2, he says, "Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats." And at En Gedi, it's in the desert, nothing but sand and rocks, and it's very, very hot and dry. It's a very narrow canyon, scrub grass around and shrubs, low-lying shrubs. And there's this natural tiny spring that just comes flowing out of the rock. You can walk in it and refresh yourself there. And apparently David and his men were at En Gedi. And Saul finally knows it. So Saul thinks, "Here's my chance. Here's my opportunity to finally take care of David permanently." In verse 3, "So he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave, and Saul went in to rest." David and his men, of course, were in the cave. And here's your situation right now. Saul and his men are probably coming along. Saul needs, the old King James says, cover his feet, which means to get a rest. And he calls a halt to all 3,000 men. He gets off his mule or his camel or his horse, and Saul makes his way up this narrow canyon, up this trail. Up, up, up he goes into a cave. Then verse 3 tells us, David and his men are far back in the cave, probably because it was much cooler way back in the cave. And King Saul is unaware that David is in the very same cave. Saul and his men were getting closer and closer to David. David's men probably spotted Saul coming, so they informed David and tell him, "Saul has discovered us." Well, David, instead of trying to run away and get away from Saul, they hide in the cave. Maybe some of them came out and hid in some of the hills around. And they allow Saul and his men to pass by. And Saul decides, well, he's going to get a rest. He's going to go into a cave and rest. Here's the question I have for you. What are the odds? When we were there, we saw many, many caves, hundreds, maybe thousands, hundreds and hundreds of miles of barren desert. And what were the odds, the chances, that Saul would enter the very same cave Dave was in? It was a God moment. It was God appointed. If ever God performed a miracle in David's life, it was this one. So if Saul is the problem, God just provided the solution. God just provided the solution. What could be any clearer direction from God? Here's Saul delivered right into David's hands. Not only is he delivered into David's hands, he's fast asleep. The men hiding in the cave with David saw this for exactly what it was. God delivered him. God delivered Saul to David. Verse 4 says, "Then the men of David said to him," so David's army, David's men are saying, "David, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, and you may do to him as it seems good to you.'" Notice, God did not say to kill him or annihilate him. He said to David, "You may do to him as it seems good to you." And David arose secretly and cut off a corner of Saul's coat. It was something like this. David and his men, they were just traveling around the desert, hiding and running. And they probably sat around the campfire to rest when they were tired. They were outlaws. And they were poor. They had left their families. They had no place to lay their heads. It was indeed a very dangerous lifestyle, running from the king. And David would encourage them, "Men, just be patient. Stick with me. Men, just be patient. Stay by my side, and one day I'll be king. Someday God is going to honor his promise to me, and I will be the king." And the men are like saying, "David, this is your promised day. This is the day we've all been waiting for. Look, David, God has clearly delivered the enemy into your hands." Imagine how easy God has made this for you, David. David, all of Saul's men saw Saul walk into this cave. But if you kill him, they will see you emerge. Can you imagine the drama at this moment? And all of Saul's army will know what actually happened. And at that moment, Saul's army will pledge to you their lives and hail you as King David, because you killed King Saul. Well, David gets caught up in all these emotions. I mean, how could he not? He's been a fugitive. He's been on the run. His own life is at stake. And here he is with the enemy alone in the cave. What could be more of a miracle of God than that? You are alone. It's David's opportunity to become king immediately. It was a godsend, so David's army thought so. Here's Saul, he's yours, David. And for a moment, David got caught up in it. Do unto Saul as Saul intends to do unto you, David. David, no one is going to blame you. No one's going to say that you did something unjust. It was just actually an act of self-defense. You just do to Saul what Saul wants to do to you, David. Okay, we're going to stop the message right now, the main message. So I want all of you to hit the pause button. You understand where we are. David, cut the robe. I want to talk to you about something. And then we'll return to David and Saul. Now, this is real important. So if you're sitting there daydreaming, or you're texting on your phone, or you're not paying attention, I have something important to tell you, and I want you to pay attention. At the root of most messes, at the root of most messes in our lives, at the root of most major mistakes, most messes we make in our lives, there's a breakdown in something. There's a breakdown in virtue. Virtue in our choices that we decide to fix the mess. A breakdown in virtue. That means a breakdown in righteousness and doing what's right. We don't do what's right. A breakdown in our integrity when we choose how to get out of our mess. A breakdown in showing high moral standards when you're trying to escape your mess. At the root of most messes, that teenage mess maybe you got into, that mess you married into, that sin mess you are or were involved in, that mess you created by yourselves, the mess with the people you hang out with, the mess you have with your relatives, the mess you have with your parents, the mess you accidentally got into. Listen to me. At the root of most messes is a breakdown of virtue, a breakdown in integrity, a breakdown in honesty, a breakdown in patience, self-control, a breakdown in putting others ahead of you, a breakdown in goodness. And when you scratch beneath the surface of any of the messes you've been in, voluntary or involuntary messes you've made, somewhere in the mess, there's a severe lack of virtue. There's a severe lack of integrity. And when you ignore virtue, eventually you make your mess messier. It's just a matter of time. It's like a cause and effect. You ignore virtue in a relationship, if you ignore virtue in your finances or in your job, if you ignore virtue or integrity or righteousness in your family, eventually, sooner or later, you're going to make a mess. And you can't clean up a failure in virtue by another failure in virtue. You don't clean up the flood by adding more water. You don't clean up the paint by adding more paint. Two wrongs never make a right, and two messes never make an un-mess. Never makes the mess right or better. You can't clean up a mess caused by failure in virtue with another failure in virtue. And here's the problem. Every mess comes with bad options, bad solutions. And those bad options are always a failure in virtue. And they are the options we are tempted to reach for first because it looks good and it's a quick fix, a fast way to get out of your mess, so you think. Somehow I'm going to turn this thing around. I'm going to make things better. Somehow I'm going to fix this mess. I'll just borrow more money. I'll just fib a little bit. I'll just cover the evidence. I just deny that I was involved. I'll just ask a friend to vouch for me and say what I'm saying is right. With every mess you get in, there are options. that reflect another failure in virtue. You do not clean up a mess created by a failure of virtue by adding another failure in virtue. Which was exactly what David was about to do when he was about to kill the king. In fact, David's men, in verse 4, it tells us, they encourage him. They encourage him to kill the king. So David crept up unnoticed. He was a warrior and he was a soldier, and it was easy for him to sneak up on Saul. After all, he was asleep anyhow. And it would be finished. It would be over. It would be Saul's final breath. As David is sneaking up on King Saul, something dawns on him. And what he thinks about, he says, I'm about to make my mess much messier. I'm about to kill the king. I'm about to kill God's king. I'm about to kill God's anointed one. I'm about to kill my father-in-law. I'm about to kill my wife's father. I'm about to kill my children's grandfather. Wow, what on earth am I thinking? And if I kill the king, if I murder the king, that will be my story for my life. Now, folks, here's where we get trapped. I want to write three words on the board. You read these words. For you folks that are listening remotely out there and somewhere, I'm writing the word justified. I'm writing the word expected. And I'm writing the word virtuous. And I put a box in front of them. Justified, expected, and virtuous. Was it justified, what David wanted to do? Sure. Everyone would say, absolutely justified, David. Saul's trying to kill you. God has given him over to you. He's delivered. It's justifiable. Well, was it expected? Absolutely, including his closest friends in the cave. They expected him to kill King Saul. Was it the right thing to do? Was it the virtuous thing to do? It was justified, and it was expected. But was it the virtuous thing to do? Was it the righteous thing to do? Was it the thing to do if you're a man of integrity? Absolutely not. Killing the king, killing King Saul, that would be a part of David's story the rest of his life. Grandpa, tell us how you became king. Well, your great-grandfather was asleep in a cave one day, and I snuck up behind him and I murdered him. That's how I became king. And when the king's son, Jonathan, asked, what happened to Dad? David, what happened to Dad? Well, I don't know exactly. I'm not really sure. He was in a cave, and he was found with his throat sliced open. You see, David was about to make a decision that he would regret for the rest of his life. Even though it was justified, even though it's what everybody expected him to do, even though it may have been what Saul deserved. So there we are in our own messes. And it consumes much of our attention. And it's our own dilemma. Because every mess comes with some really, really bad options. Then Samuel tells us that David crept up and cut the corner of the coat. What did David's men think when David crept up closer and closer and closer, and David had the perfect opportunity to settle the King Saul problem forever? And instead, he cuts off the king's coat. And afterwards, Samuel tells us in verse 5, "Now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut off Saul's coat or robe. See the sensitive heart and the sensitive mind in a man with integrity. It bothered him that he would even cut the coat. His conscience bothered him of the anointed. And verse 6 says, "And he said to his men, 'The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, cut off his coat, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord.'" Men, I almost forgot. God put Saul in place. Saul is God's appointed. And I don't want to become king by murdering the king. So some of Saul's men said, "Well, we'll be glad to do it for you. We can take care of this." Verse 7, "So David restrained his servants with these words." He held them back and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and went on his way. Now what happens next in our story is absolutely unbelievable, unreal. And this is part of David's story that's exceptionally powerful. Saul's men are scattered about the base of the hillside there in En-Gedi with the goats around and the desert and the shrubbery. Some are sitting on mules, some are resting. It's hot, sun is hot, it's in the Dead Sea Valley. They're waiting, and finally, here comes Saul out of the cave. He's made his way down the path from the cave, and Saul's army is about to continue their hunt for David. They're about to leave the cave where David is in En-Gedi, and David appears at the mouth of the cave, and everybody looks toward the cave. David also arose afterwards, went out of the cave, and called out to Saul, "My lord and king." Notice the submission. It's not just a submission. What it is total dependence on God. It's total dependence on God. "My lord and my king." That's what he called his enemy here. And when Saul looked behind him, David did more than call him lord and king, offer him obeisance. He stooped with his face to the earth and bowed toward the king. And David went out of the cave further and called to Saul. And everybody in Saul's army knew immediately what had just not happened. Here's what happens next. David gives this little speech. Listen to what David has to say. "And David said to Saul, 'Why do you listen to the words of men who say, indeed, David seeks you harm? Look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you, Saul, into my hands in this cave. And someone urged me to kill you. My men urged me to kill you. But I spared you, and I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Not only did I not kill you, I kept my men from killing you. I defended you, Saul, and protected you, because I would not lay my hand on you, the Lord's anointed. And Saul, you may not be acting like the Lord's anointed. As a matter of fact, you're probably a sorry example of the Lord's anointed. But nevertheless, Saul, you are the Lord's anointed. And I'm not going to replace what God has put in place." Then David makes a very interesting and profound statement. David says something that some of you here today need to lock on to this, and you need to grasp it. This is so, so important. "Let the Lord judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me and you. but my hand shall not be against you. May the Lord judge between us, King Saul. You wronged me, but my hand never touched you. At this point, what happens? As the soldiers on both sides, David's soldiers and Saul's soldiers, recount this story and retell this story, David becomes a man of valor, a man of integrity, a man of leadership, a virtuous man, and his popularity goes to the greatest heights. It couldn't get any higher. So what was David saying to Saul and all the soldiers? King Saul, soldiers, all of Israel, I'm opting for virtue. I'm doing what is right. I'm doing what a man of integrity does. Over getting even. I'm not getting even. I'm not hurting him. Over my desire even to hurt him. And over my plans, I'm opting for virtue. I'm choosing the unheard of. I'm taking the high road. I'm walking the virtuous path. I've acted in such a way that puts me in the category of one. Well, what can Saul do at this point? His soldiers are in awe of David. What David does is completely unheard of as a soldier in a world of bloodshed where death comes easy and life comes cheap. So Saul says back to David, "Today, David, it is evident to all that you are a better man than I am." Then Saul continues, "You are more righteous than I, for you have rewarded me with good, whereas I have rewarded you, David, with evil. And David, you have shown this day how you have dealt well with me, for when the Lord delivered me into your hands, David, you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him get away safely? Therefore, may the Lord reward you, David, with good for what you have done to me this day. And now I know indeed that you shall surely be king someday, David, and that the kingdom of Israel, David, shall be established in your hand." So Saul retreats. He turns around and takes his army and goes back to Jerusalem. 7 chapters later, we find out that a stray Philistine arrow pierced somewhere his armor, and Saul is killed 7 chapters later by the Philistines. And David becomes king of Israel. So what's all this about today, and why do you care? Well, here's your take home. I want you to catch this part. This is what you're going to take home with you today. Every mess you're in comes with a prepackaged list of bad and wrong options. Every mess you're in or were in comes with a list of prepackaged bad and wrong options. And if you choose the bad option, you will make your mess much messier. Here's the thing again, in case you've tuned me out here. Because you won't even believe what I'm about to tell you now. But those of us, now listen to this, this is important. Those of us who are older, if you're 45 or older, you are going to understand this completely. If you're younger, you're not going to understand this. Those of us who are older will get it. Here's the reality in your life, my friends. If you can remember this, it will help you so much. Remember what I'm about to tell you. This is your take home for today. You see, eventually, the messes that you are experiencing right now, or the mess you're going to be in sooner or later, listen, that whole mess will someday be reduced to just one or 2 sentences. And it won't be this mess that it is today. Because this season in your life, when you're in a mess, this is the most painful and most complicated and most horrible season in your life. But believe me, coming from an old man, it's proven true and true and true. The day will come when this entire season of your life and this entire mess that you're in will be reduced to nothing more than one or two sentences. Something like this. You know, 5 years ago, I really went through a terrible divorce, beginning and end. That's it. All of my pain, all of my loneliness, all the suffering, it's all reduced to 5 years ago, I really went through a terrible divorce. Those of you that are listening remotely, I'm just giving examples. 4 years ago, I had to declare bankruptcy. And all those events that surrounded bankruptcy and how you told all your friends and you tried to borrow money and the whole mess, you reduce it to one sentence. 4 years ago, I declared bankruptcy. 7 years ago, through horrible turmoil, we had a church split, and it led to devastation. One sentence. 7 years ago, the church split. 3 years ago, I got arrested. 6 weeks ago, the doctors told me, one sentence. 2 years ago, I had to move away from my family. 10 years ago, Mom and Dad packed us up and moved us across the country away from all my friends. All those horrible messes, one sentence. All those momentous life events, all of these horrible messes, eventually are reduced to one or two sentences. Here's my sentence. Here's my drama. No one knows this about me, not even my wife. No one knows this about me, and you're the first to hear it. Finally, everybody's looking. Great, great. And this is true. When Brother Ted, one little guy is going to talk. Chad, you want to hear my mess. Are you ready? Chad has sat there and listened the whole time. Here is my drama, my sentence that no one knows. At age 16, I was arrested. Did I go to court? Yes. Was I found guilty? Yes. No, I've never told that to anybody. No one knows that. My valuable lesson, I decided after I left the courthouse that day, that moment in time, I wanted my life to be different. And I really didn't want to be the Ted that I saw. That was my mess. At the time, it was months and months and months of turmoil because I kept it all inside and didn't tell anybody. Of course, everybody knew I came from a small town. We had a newspaper, and it always had the court news. And one day I read it. There it was. Ted Gilmer, arrested, blah, 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 blah. Another take home for you. Your response to your mess, and don't miss this, the way you respond to your mess is your real story. It's the story of your life. My mess being arrested is not my story. My life is the decision to change. That's my story, and that's made my life. Your response to your mess is your real story. This is really, really big, guys. The real story is not the mess. It's not divorce. It's not bankruptcy. It's not being arrested. The real story isn't your mess. The mess is still the mess. And many times there's little or nothing you can do about it. You can't unscramble eggs. You can't go back and relive your history. Your real story is your response to your mess. That's your real story. That's David's real story, how he responded. Your response to your mess becomes a permanent part of your life. It becomes the story of your life. Your response to your mess, not just the mess, but your response to the mess, becomes a permanent part of your story, of your life. Which brings us to the big question. Somehow, some way between David's friends and King Saul in the cave, it dawned on David. What story do I want to tell? What story do I want to tell? When people ask me, David, how did you become king of Israel? What story do you want to tell when people hear about your mess? You got arrested. Yeah, and it changed my life. I made a decision. The response. When people hear about your dysfunctional family, your childhood, or your divorce, your lonely marriage, yeah, you got caught cheating at school, got caught cheating in your schoolwork, what's your response? Because your response to your mess is what becomes your life story, the permanent part, the real story of your life. So let me ask it this way. Which of my options do I want as a permanent part of my life story? And I can answer that question for you. You already know what my answer is. You know what the answer is. You know what the options are. What's my answer to my story? I want the virtuous answer. I want the high moral standard answer. I want the righteous standard. I want the integrity. I want what's doing right. I told the police officer the truth. I told him the truth. I confessed it. Before I got caught, that was the virtuous thing to do. I turned myself in. Maybe your case would be, I asked them exactly what I owed them, and I told them, if it takes the rest of my life, I'm going to start paying you back. Maybe your answer is what my answer was 22 years ago. I cut up all my credit cards and threw them away. That ended that mess. I went to my neighbors and I apologized. That ended that mess. I went to my parents and I apologized. I went to my sister in the church. I went to my brother in the church at Ephrata and I asked forgiveness. Which of your options do you want as your permanent record, a permanent part of the story of your life? Because the real story is not the mess. Everybody has had or will have messes. It's what you do with the mess. It's how you address the mess. It's how you respond to your mess. That's the real story of your life. I guess what I'm saying is, I just don't want any of you to add more water to your flood. I don't want any of you to add more paint to the spill. I don't want any of you to make things worse for yourself, or at church, or at work, or at home, or with relationships. So don't choose options that make you a liar for life. After you've cheated at school, after you've gotten caught, after you lied, what do? Make up a story. Make up a story. Lie some more. Don't opt for anything that makes you a liar for life. Don't opt for anything that makes you a hypocrite for life. Young people, this is important. You young people, please don't use someone else's bad behavior to excuse your own bad behavior. Well, Dad, everybody else is doing it. Well, Dad, you and Mom, you're always fighting. Why can't I fight with my brother or sister? Please don't use someone else's bad behavior for your excuse to behave badly. This was David's dilemma. He had every reason in the world to use Saul's bad behavior as an excuse for his bad behavior. Here's what I'm saying. Because some of you have been, are in some really tough circumstances today, at home or with relationships, with your parents maybe acting poorly, with your friends. Young people, those of you that are starting to run around with friends, it's not natural for a young person to say, if that's the way you're going to treat me, or if that's the way my parents are and that's the way my friends are, then it's okay for me to be that way too. All you're going to do, young people, is make your mess messier. You're going to make your mess you're in 10 times worse. Well, if the preacher did that, I can do it too. No, you can't use somebody else's bad behavior to excuse your own behavior. This is not the story you want to tell anybody. I understand when finding ourselves in a mess, me included, I want a quick fix. You know, just lie one more time, just get alone, just one more. Everybody wants a quick fix. They went out of it. But think about this for a moment. Think of the story you'll have the opportunity to tell. David, how did you become the king? I did what no one expected me to do. I did what no one else would do. I didn't do what I could get away with. I opted for virtue, righteousness, integrity over a quick fix. That would be David's answer. David would say something like, I trusted my father. In heaven to take care of this for me. David would say, I trusted my Father in heaven to take care of this for me. Can you say that today? Or are you trying to fix it yourself? A quick fix that lacks integrity. Now look up here. If you're a Christian, I want you to get this final part. Final part. Everyone look up here. This is why Jesus told us in the Word. Jesus said, follow me. People, follow me. This is why Jesus doesn't just fix our mess overnight. He says, follow me, and I'm going to lead you out. And if you follow me through the mess, we are, you and I, we are going to walk around and we're going to sidestep a whole lot of bad and wrong options that most people would choose. We're going to dodge some options that your friends would choose. We're going to dodge some options that your friends would say, are you kidding me? You can easily get out of it. Just say this and just do that. Just sneak the car in the garage. Put the key on the shelf. No one will know how late it was. But Jesus says, I want you to follow me. I want you to follow me, James. I want you to follow me, Galen. I want you to follow me, Jesus says. I want you to follow me. I'm going to walk you around a whole lot of bad options. And one day, when you talk about your mess, and your children and grandchildren ask you about your mess, you're going to sum it up in one or two sentences. When you talk about your response to your mess, you won't have to lie. You won't have to be a hypocrite. Jesus says, follow me. Simple. Follow me. And I will help your mess become a message of your life. That's what I do. Jesus says, I redeem bad things. I redeem sinners. I redeem messes. I bring triumph out of tragedy. If you follow your Savior, that's the way out. of your mess. Folks, what story do you want to tell? What story do you want to tell? Which of your options do you want to be to have as a permanent part of your life story? As a permanent part of your life. God bless each of you. And may you, with God's help, grow in the Lord and become more and more virtuous as the days and the weeks in the years pass. And once again, God bless you.
Well, thank you, Brother Ted, for that very practical message on how not to make our messes messier. I appreciate some of those thoughts that you had shared about how that there's in the situations we find ourselves in, how we can find it's so easy to do the wrong thing. There's so many options, wrong options out there that on the surface may look well. And also appreciate your admonition to that after 5, 10, 20 years, that what we think is a big deal today, 5, 10 years from now, it'll be just referred to as a sentence. Okay, anyone else have any testimonies or comments on the message this morning? Brother Mervin.
Mine goes back to Ted's talking a story of David there in the cave, and yeah, it looked like his opportunity to take things in his own hands. But then Ted brought out, you know, what are you going to tell your grandchildren? How did you become king? And I just have to say, you know, now that you put it that way, it looks different. And, you know, how often do we take things in our own hands? David could have done that there. And I just had a talk with somebody this week that was pretty upset with his neighbor. And I just had an opportunity to talk with him and, you know, help him think through the consequences of what I think he wanted to do. And, yeah, may we not take things in our own hands, but, you know, see God's side in it.
Yeah, I think the one of the main underlying points of the message is how important it is to have character, to be men and women of character. I think that's something that we need to strive in our own lives and for those of us that have children, to place that in our children's lives as well. Anyone else? Brother Ed.
Appreciate the reminder that it's not so much our problems and the messes that we have, but how we respond to them that makes a difference.
Amen.
And that's what I want to keep in mind, that it's how I respond is what's going to make the difference. And also just a reminder that our mess can become our message. And how God can use those messes in our lives to become our life story, our life message, to convey God's grace and mercy to others that may be in messes that need help and hope. Also, I was thinking during Brother Mike's message about that envelope with something in it. You know, God has given us the message of the gospel, as he pointed out, and we're basically in debt until we deliver that message. And Paul said in Romans 1:14, I am a debtor to both to the Greeks, to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. So as much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are in Rome also. And I want to say I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it's the power of God unto salvation. So when we are given that responsibility, that message, then we're a debtor until we deliver that message. Just as if we're given money, we're a debtor until we give that money to whoever it's supposed to go to. So I want to remember to keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Go ahead, Brother Galen.
I can certainly add my affirmation to what was said and heard. And one of the privileges is when you're up front speaking, if a long time thereafter somebody comes and reminds you what you said. And somebody did that here not too long ago, reminded me of some things I had said. I had spoken about the issue of iniquity. This is an incredible example, well laid out in front of us. And it's interesting because had David taken Saul's life at that point, there probably wouldn't have been any questions, except for in David's mind. But, you know, it would have been case closed. Everybody would have understood why it was done. And they would have moved on. Rah, rah, rah. David's already on the ascendancy. You know, give him the kingship and let's get on with things. At least that's certainly a viable possibility, I would believe. But David would have had to violate the covenant that he had between he and the Lord. And there are those places where, not often, but I know I've experienced it also, where everyone, to a man, including those people in appropriate authority, are saying, yes, go ahead. It's a good thing to move ahead. But inwardly there is a check that you know that you're going to have to violate something about the Lord's design for your life. Somebody else, it might be okay for them to do, but for you, no. And this is just an excellent example, well put out. You know, David could have looked at this and said, well, yeah, this is miraculous. Look at this very time and place, you know, and nobody will know quite what happened, you know. And he could have spun on, but he knew that there was that place where it would violate the Lord's provision in his life.
Thank you, brother, for sharing that.
Thank you for listening to this message. We trust that it has been a blessing to you. If you would like additional sermons or a catalog, please visit our website at effortofministries.org. Call us toll-free at 855-557-7902 or write to us at Effort of Ministries, 400 West Main Street, Suite 1, Effort of Pennsylvania, 17522. You are welcome to copy this message for free distribution. This ministry is supported by your donations. May the Lord Jesus bless you.